Redeemer Digital Media Ministry presents the Reverend Dr. Carl Ficken, presenting a lecture on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Session 1 is on The Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It was recorded on January 29, 2012 in Rudisill Hall at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Midtown Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, it's good to be with you all, and look forward to these 4 weeks with you. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Dear God, we give you thanks for the great teachers of your church, for the faithfulness of and the thoughtfulness of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. We ask your guidance as we study about his life and his work, and ask that you would enrich us with his sense of your strong word of grace. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Bonhoeffer is a complicated personality because he's not like a lot of other theologians. I mean, most theologians go up, they go to graduate school, they get their degrees, they start teaching, they write books, they go to retirement, and then they fade off into the sunset somewhere. That's not the story of Bonhoeffer's life at all. I want to spend today talking about Bonhoeffer's life because it seems to me that his life and understanding his life is vitally important as background for reading any of his works. And I don't think that's necessarily true of a lot of other theologians. But it's a complicated story, and Bonhoeffer's own thought process is complicated because primarily of the prison years. I don't know how many of you have read much of Bonhoeffer, and if you don't mind, I'd like to take a little poll so have a sense of that. How many of you read anything by Bonhoeffer? Okay, a number of you have. Let's just see what sort of things those are. Letters and Papers from Prison. Life Together. Cost of Discipleship. Those are probably the three most popular books, I would guess. Anybody read any of the heavier theological stuff like Act and Being or Sanctorum Communio? No. No, that's a little tougher stuff. But one of the problems we face is that Bonhoeffer said some things in the prison letters that were extremely challenging for the Christian community and faith. In fact, they opened up doors to all sorts of possibilities. It's very interesting. Martin Marty has written a little book that is called A Biography of Letters and Papers from Prison. I don't know whether you've ever read a biography of a book before, but that's what it is. And it's a little series that somebody's doing. But he points out in there how many people interpreted Bonhoeffer to their favor. Communist in Eastern Germany saw him as their guy. The radical theologians, you remember the radical theologians of the 60s at Emory, the God is Dead folks? Altizer, yeah. They got some of their meat from Bonhoeffer, they said. And now, in some sense, some evangelical Christians are trying to claim Bonhoeffer. So it's an interesting spectrum there. You wouldn't think it would work that way, but it does. But in order to understand that and get some handles on that, I think we do need to look carefully at his life and then at his work. As I said, it's a complicated story. There are a number of biographies of Bonhoeffer, some long and some short. This was done by his friend and colleague Eberhard Bethge. There's a more recent one than this one, and it's in the library. We have a great collection of Bonhoeffer material in our library, partly because Sally Miller was also a fan of Bonhoeffer. And the more recent volume of Bethge's work is thicker than this one. So there's also a fairly new biography done by Eric Metaxas, who is an evangelical Christian. And it's interesting also, and I think has some helpful insights to it. Let me just put those names up there. Bethke. Eberhard Bethke was Bonhoeffer's colleague and friend, and was a student of Bonhoeffer's at the seminary in Finkenwald. And then Metaxas. Now, the first thing I want to say about Bonhoeffer's story is about his family background, because it's really pretty amazing. He came from a cultured upper middle class family. I don't think they were in the 1%, but they were well to do and intellectual and all of that, and had a great tradition. His maternal great grandfather was Carl August von Hasse, his years are 1800 to 1890, and he was a dogmatic theologian, a professor of theology at the University of Jena, and this is part of the story, was at one point jailed for his support of freedom of a student corporation. His maternal grandfather, the son of Carl August, was Carl Alfred von Hasse, who was a chaplain to Kaiser Wilhelm, and who resigned in a dispute with the emperor over his right to preach in public. His years were 1842 to 1914. His paternal grandmother, Julie Bonhoeffer, at the age of 91 in 1933, during the infamous Kristallnacht, when the Nazis attacked all the Jewish people and merchants and all, at the age of 91, Julie Bonhoeffer walked through the Nazi soldiers and all to shop at the stores of her Jewish friends. So this is a family who's has some history of being somewhat rebellious about the status quo. His father, Bonhoeffer's father, his name was Carl also. He was a professor of psychiatry and neurology, first at the University of Breslau, that's the area where Bonhoeffer was born, and that's eastern Germany. I think it's now in Poland, as a matter of fact, but it's the eastern part of the state. But in 1912, Carl Bonhoeffer was invited to come to the University of Berlin and taught there for the rest of his career from 1912 to 1948 when he died. And so was the leading psychiatrist in Berlin. And Carl Bonhoeffer was not a Christian. He was an agnostic, very bright man, very influential, and important figure in that time. Bonhoeffer's mother, Paula, was the person who managed the house, who taught the faith, who raised the children. And she was very serious. They were not church-going people. They didn't go to church. But Paula Bonhoeffer raised the children in the faith. And Carl Bonhoeffer did not object to that at all. He was okay with her doing that. But she would teach them the hymns of the church, teach them the Bible, and they would, in their family, do what many of us do more often at church, I suppose. Dietrich was born, he and his twin sister Sabine were born on February the 4th, 1906, the sixth and seventh of eight children. He grew up a Berliner, played with the children of other professors at the University of Berlin, and was athletic and talented musically, and played the piano, was a hiker and a tennis player and a poet of sorts. The disturbance of the family in the early years was the death of his brother Walter in World War I. Early on, Dietrich Bonhoeffer decided that he wanted to study theology. Now, that came as a bit of a surprise to his older brothers and to his father, no doubt. And when he was 14, he had talked about this. He wanted to study theology. And they told him, that is, the brothers and the father, that the church was, and I'm quoting now, a poor, feeble, boring, petty bourgeois institution. And Bonhoeffer said, in that case, I shall reform it. Well, his parents respected his choice. And Eberhard Bethke points out that for Bonhoeffer to even think about becoming a pastor was a bit of a come down for the family. I mean, his older brothers were into science, and they had degrees. They were teaching in universities or in the industry and that sort of thing. His father was that way. So for him to think about being a pastor was like a step down for the family. But Bethke points out that Bonhoeffer always had a kind of urge to independence. And Bethke says, because he was lonely, he became a theologian. And because he was a theologian, he was lonely. But for Bonhoeffer, really, faith and a sense of what the church means. Remember, when he decides at 14 he wants to study theology, he hadn't been in a church much. So for Bonhoeffer, faith and a strong theological perspective and a commitment to the church would come later. At 16, he entered the University of Tübingen and spent a couple of terms there. He had 3 months of travel in 1923 when he went to Rome and saw something for the first time about the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, there were Catholics in Germany, of course, but the predominant church in his area was the Lutheran Church. And Bonhoeffer saw the Vatican and saw something of the universality of the church, the liturgy of the church, and the concreteness of the church that he perhaps had not really experienced very much earlier in his career. He also traveled briefly on that trip to North Africa. Then, when he came back in 1924 to 27, he was studying at the University of Berlin. Some of the great theologians of that time, Adolf von Harnack and Karl Hall and Reinhold Seeberg, were the theologians there, Luther scholars and systematicians, and they were Bonhoeffer's teachers. By the way, there was a funny story that Pastor Smith told me that when at the Bible study group last week, Pastor Goak told the people about this series and asked and told them that one of the things that Brian said was Pastor Ficken taught Bonhoeffer at the seminary. And meaning, of course, that I taught courses in Bonhoeffer. But someone thought, Pastor Ficken taught Bonhoeffer? And I know I'm old, but not that old. The result of his work at University of Berlin was the thesis that where he earned his doctorate degree, his licentiate in theology, It was a study of the church. The Latin title is Sanctorum Communio, the communion of saints. And we'll take a look at some of that next week. But he was interested in examining the church. And again, this is a guy who hadn't had a whole lot of experience in the life of the church. In these years, while he was at the University of Berlin, he did get involved in teaching a Sunday school class of young people. But his degree was its sort of first step in this development of the theologian. In 1928-29, he went to Barcelona. He served a year as a pastor, an associate pastor, in a German-speaking Lutheran church in Barcelona. And that was a formative experience for him because it was the first time he had really been totally immersed in the life of a congregation. And he enjoyed it. He liked it. He liked talking to the people. He liked working with folks and teaching and having conversations and went to some bullfights and really began to understand something about the life of a parish. In 1929, he was back in Berlin as a lecturer, and he completed the second step in becoming a professional theologian, and that is to get your admission to the theological faculty. You had to write another big paper. This was the book Act and Being, which is a more difficult theological treatise, but that was the next step. So he was now qualified to teach theology at the university. In 1930, he was granted a leave of study for study at Union Seminary in New York. He came here partly because he wanted some exposure to American religious life and to see something about what was going on at an American seminary. Union, of course, is one of the big old schools, theological schools in the country. And Reinhold Niebuhr was there and several other people whose names you might recognize. But Niebuhr immediately recognized in Bonhoeffer a brilliant and theologically sensitive young man, he said. But it was also here that Bonhoeffer saw something of the American church and didn't necessarily like what he saw. He said at one point that he thought the American Protestantism was Protestantism without the Reformation. One of the things he enjoyed most about his time in America was his experience at African-American churches in Harlem. There were African-American students at the Union Seminary, and he went with them to some of those congregations and was really caught up by the spirit and liveliness of worship in those congregations. And took some of that tradition back to Germany with him. He also traveled a good bit. He had some friends among the students there. He traveled. They rented an Oldsmobile and traveled into the South of the United States. So he saw a lot of what was happening in the South in those days. They also went into Mexico for a time. So certainly a broadening experience for him, and of course won friends for him at Union Seminary, and that will be a part of the story as we pick it up. He came back to Berlin in 1931. The elections in 1930 had given the National Socialist Party leadership. And that and two other important events would be significant for the rest of Bonhoeffer's life. For one thing, he met and talked with Karl Barth, who was probably the greatest theologian of that that period, Swiss theologian who had published a good bit at this point. he had begun to study Bart, and one point when he went to a lecture where Bart was speaking, and he in the discussion afterward, Bonhoeffer managed to express out loud a quotation from Martin Luther to the effect that the curse of the godless can sound more pleasant in God's ears than the alleluias of the pious. And Bart said, "Who threw that in?" And that was the beginning of a friendship, and sometimes a kind of contentious relationship between the two of them. But it was an important piece of his development. But the second piece was that it was also a time of great change for Bonhoeffer because of his work in the church. He was ordained as a pastor in November 1931. So it was clear, you see, that he wasn't going to necessarily be the teaching theologian fixed in a university. But he had learned in Barcelona and in Berlin and in America something about parish life. And he was attracted to that and wanted to give his life in that direction, working in the church, doing biblical study, and praying with the people of God. He also attended a conference of the World Alliance for Promoting International Friendship Through the Churches, a long title, but it was one of the early ecumenical movements in Europe. And he also attended the International Youth Conference and was elected the youth secretary for Germany and Central Europe. So he began to be involved in ecumenical activity. In the summer of 1932, he gave a lecture that is printed in No Rusty Swords, I think, as "The Church is Dead." He wasn't saying the church is dead. Someone had said that to him. Somebody had said to him, "The church is dead," not unlike what his family had said to him earlier. But Bonhoeffer had said, "The believer says that the church lives in the midst of death because God calls it from death to life." Now, it was January 30th, 1933, when Hitler became Chancellor of the Reich. The Bonhoeffer family immediately understood what this meant, and they said, "This means war." And Bonhoeffer made the point that the church has only one altar, thus distinguishing between sort of national loyalty and the importance of faith and one's commitment to the church. Hitler became Chancellor of the Reich on January 30th. On February the 1st, Bonhoeffer delivered a radio sermon entitled "Changes in the Concept of the Führer," the leader, and warned against the possibility of idolatry in glorifying a ruler and sort of replacing the ruler, giving the ruler, the political figure, more authority and power than God. The broadcast was somehow cut off before it was finished. But that was Bonhoeffer's first instance of conflict with the state. And in March of that year, the first Aryan laws were passed, and the persecution of the Jews began. And it wasn't just persecution of the Jews, it was an onslaught against the church, against many of the principles that anyone understood. That meant that Bonhoeffer was now a public figure. He had publicly spoken against the regime, and he could no longer really lead a private existence. The German church was thrown into turmoil by all of this, partly because the government wanted to change the church. The Old Testament, of course, was inappropriate, because who was in the Old Testament? Jews. Wipe that out. What to do about Jesus being a Jew? Oh, well, they said, actually, Jesus came from pure Nordic stock. But the German church was clearly divided. You know about churches and patriotism. Well, the German church was very patriotic. And they did not think that what Hitler was doing was wrong, because Hitler was saying it and Hitler had the power and that was the way it worked. And so that seemed to be the way it was going to go. But the German church, the government wanted to establish a Reichsbishop, that is, a bishop who would be the government's servant and would carry out the wishes of the government. And that created a divide in the church and a split in the church. Many Christians began to... Well, there was a great synod meeting called the Brown Synod, because the followers of Hitler wore brown shirts, including the pastors, to that event to signify their loyalty. And they approved at the Brown Synod in... by some 70%, they approved the Bishop Müller as the Reichsbishop, and they set in place laws that would say no, there could be no new ministers unless they support the National Socialist State, and they also had to be of pure Aryan descent. So, the rebels against that became known as the first as the Pastors' Emergency League, a group of young reformers who were trying to address some of the issues. Took that name for a while, but then they became known as the Confessing Church. That is, these were the people who were confessing the historic faith of the church and were opposing the state-enforced. Well, it wouldn't be theology, but Hitlerology or something like that, I suppose. So this becomes a huge issue for the church. What are we going to do about this? The Jewish question becomes a huge issue for the church. Because Jews were banned from ministry, and there were many Jews who had converted to Christianity and was. Bonhoeffer's brother-in-law, Gerhard Leipholz, who had married his twin sister Sabine, was of Jewish background. And there's a little interesting story that Leipholz's father died. His father was, of course, of Jewish background as well, had not been baptized. And Leipholz asked Bonhoeffer if he would preside at the funeral. And Bonhoeffer wasn't sure what to do about that. And he consulted some church officials and was advised not to do that. And later, he apologized profusely to Leipholz for not having the courage to do what he knew he should have done, and that is do the funeral for a family member and a friend and a person of faith. Well, shortly after these events and the development of the church, Bonhoeffer went to England. He became a pastor there of two German-speaking Lutheran congregations. And this gave him ecumenical contacts, especially introduced him to Bishop Bell, who was one of the leaders in England of the ecumenical movement, and also deepened his pastoral interest. he attended international ecumenical meetings, went to one in Denmark, the World Alliance, and at that event, a statement was passed denouncing the National Socialist Church. And that was in August 1934. It was also in this time period that Bonhoeffer was very much inclined toward pacifism and wanted to, thought it would be valuable, interesting to go to India and meet Mahatma Gandhi. That never happened for him, but that was something he was very much interested in. After a couple of years in England, he was called back to Germany by the Confessing Church and asked to lead a seminary. Now, theological students in those days in Germany went to the university for their theological training. They didn't necessarily get a whole lot of training in sort of congregational life or how to be a pastor. They had their theological training, and then the church would approve them for ordination. But the Confessing Church was now in a spot because they no longer had the control over the system, you see. So they decided that they would develop some seminaries. They were really illegal seminaries. But they asked Bonhoeffer to lead one of these seminaries, and that was a really striking period of his life because he had about 25 students, and he led them. He could teach them theology, but he also led them in devotional life. They had daily morning prayer and worship and Bible study, and they did things together. They took hikes and they traveled sometimes. He took a group of them to Sweden once for an ecumenical meeting. And it was an extremely informative period for the students who were there with him. And one of those students was Eberhard Bethge. And he and Bonhoeffer became great friends. And Bethge would, of course, then be the recipient of many of Bonhoeffer's letters from prison and would be the person who put those letters and papers together in that book. It was during these years while he was at Finkenwald, and Finkenwald is sort of up in the northeastern, northwestern part of Germany, not far from the coast. It was also a place where there were family connections fairly near, in the town nearby, and so Bonhoeffer had some contacts there. That would be important later on. It was in these years that he wrote The Cost of Discipleship, a study of the Sermon on the Mount, and Life Together, which is about his experience with the students at the seminary. And, of course, he was involved all this time in the work of the Confessing Church and the ecumenical activity and with some lectures at the University of Berlin. In 1936... he was forbidden to lecture at the university, and by September of 1937, the seminary was closed by the state. Now, things are getting really tough. We're getting close to 1939, and Hitler's already made invasions into Poland. Things are really bad. I mean, The German army did not simply go into Poland and take over territory. They killed everybody they saw. I mean, that was their strategy. They didn't take prisoners. They just killed people. And they began this attempt to sort of purify the state for all people of Aryan blood sort of went crazy. They decided that there was no longer any need to keep people who were in nursing homes or hospitals who could not take care of themselves any longer. The state, that kind of burden should not fall on the state. And besides that, they were useless people. So they were euthanized. That was the strategy of the government. And, of course, the possibility of war was there. It was going on. And one of the great issues for Bonhoeffer's friends was, how are we going to keep Dietrich out of the army? And we don't want him to be a conscientious objector, because they just killed conscientious objectors and put them in prison and eventually killed them. So there was no room for that. But they were frightened that Bonhoeffer might be drafted. So they were trying to figure out what they could do about that. One plan was, let's get him out of the country. Let's send him to America again. He could go to Union. He could teach there. That'd be great. Bonhoeffer went to England for a little while, talked to some folks there about it. He had mixed feelings about it, but he finally agreed to go. And they had made arrangements for him to have a lectureship at Union. And he got on the boat. He had misgivings all the way over there. He landed in New York. He had trouble getting off the boat because he wasn't sure he wanted to do this thing. 2 weeks later, he told the people at Union he couldn't do it. And he said, Christians in Germany face the terrible alternative of either willing the defeat of their nation so that Christian civilization can survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby destroying that civilization. I know which I must choose, he said, but I cannot make that choice in security. I shall have no right to participate in the reconstruction of the Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. So Bonhoeffer goes back to Germany. And so the question is up again. What's going to happen? How are we going to keep Dietrich out of the army? How are we going to keep Dietrich from getting into trouble? Well, the solution was, and it may seem a strange one, but the solution was to put Bonhoeffer in the resistance movement. There was a resistance movement. Some of Bonhoeffer's relatives, his brother-in-law, Hans Vachtanagy, was one of the people who was very high up in the German Secret Service, or the Military Intelligence Department. If that's not an oxymoron, I don't know, but probably not. I think we're seeing some pretty bright people in our military now. But anyway, Hans Vachtanagy was already in the Abwehr. He was a leader of it. And they were already plotting. They were already trying to figure out a way to stop Hitler. So they hired Bonhoeffer, put him on the staff. This enabled him to do several things. It gave him, for example, the possibility of traveling to Switzerland or to England or to Sweden, making contact with ecumenical people there. It gave him some time to write. He didn't have to, this wasn't actually a full-time job. He would be sent on little missions, but lots of what the Abwehr was doing was trying to subvert Hitler's strategies. So some of their work was, for example, to get endangered Jews out of the country, and Bonhoeffer participated in that. But Bonhoeffer had come to the conclusion, we talked about him having been a pacifist, but he had come to the conclusion that in this circumstance, with this particular man at the head of state, something had to be done, and he was willing to consider the assassination of Hitler as a necessity. And the analogy he used was, if you see a crazy person driving on the street and killing people, running over people, you have a responsibility to try to stop that. He talked about it as putting a spoke in the wheel, you have to imagine old-time wheels that had spokes, and if you could ram a rod between the spokes there, you could stop the vehicle. But he saw that as a responsibility of people who were unhappy with the way Hitler was doing. And working in the Abwehr did enable Bonhoeffer to avoid the military draft. and enabled him to keep up his ecumenical contacts. Part of the ecumenical interest there was that the Germans in the resistance movement were hoping that they could communicate through the ecumenical community, especially in England, with the Allies, so that if they succeeded in killing Hitler, there could be the Allies would understand that there was a body of people who were responsible for that and who were willing to lead the country in a different direction. And so perhaps the Allies then would not simply sweep into Germany and wipe everything out. That was their hope and strategy. It never really took on. The Allies were never totally convinced, I guess, that the resistance movement was that strong. And indeed, it really wasn't that strong. But Bonhoeffer had come now to see Hitler really as an antichrist, as someone who must be eliminated. But he did not take that with any sense of pride. He rather understood, as he said to Bishop Bell, "Our action must be understood as an act of repentance." In March of 1943, bombs were placed on a plane carrying, they were supposed to carry Hitler. They failed to explode. They were in brandy bottles. A week later, the resistance team tried again, this time a major who was also in the Abwehr put the bombs in his pocket and boarded the plane himself. But that plot failed, and that led to the unraveling of the movement. And on April the 5th, Hans Wacht Benigni, his wife Christine, Bonhoeffer's sister, and Bonhoeffer were implicated and were arrested. And that was that's the beginning of the last part of the Bonhoeffer story. It is a painful part. He was in prison in several different places. He was able to continue to work and write. He actually had been working on the book Ethics while he was doing this Abwehr stuff, and he was able to get off by himself on several occasions to do some writing. He continued writing Ethics in prison. He was able to make friends with the guards, and that again is a testimony to his own character and personality. They saw in him a person who was caring for other people and who was kind to them, and they responded by helping him. Helping him sometimes smuggle letters out or get things in. His parents were able to visit him a few times. I forgot to mention that during this time that he was in the Abwehr, he also became attracted to a young woman who was related to a family that he had known while he was at Finkenwald, not far from there. In fact, he had seen Maria when she was a child, and he was the leader of the seminary at Finkenwald. But now she was older, and Bonhoeffer came in contact with her again, and they had they sort of dated and got to know one another and became engaged shortly before he was imprisoned. And she was also able to visit him in prison from time to time. But the prison years were difficult because he was, of course, it was a confined area. There were often nights when the bombs would fall and the prisoners would be threatened and some killed, perhaps. But it was also in this time that he began to write letters to Bethke. And his theology began to take a new shape. He began to ask some new questions, and we'll look at those in more detail. But he was asking questions like, what is the meaning of Christ today? How do we understand God today in this situation, in this war, in this abomination of what Hitler has done to our country and to the world? How do we talk about God as the beyond in the midst of life? How is Christ a person for others? And does that not suggest that we also must be people for others? So, Bonhoeffer spent, he went in from in July, in April of 1943, and through 44 and into early 45, he was moved several times. Of course, the war was wearing down, the Allies were advancing, and Bonhoeffer was eventually taken to Buchenwald in February. He was the prisoners were carted about in trucks. They didn't really have these were trucks operated by wood burning engines. So they would have to stop and fire. I don't understand how that works really, but they had to stop and fire up the. Get all the. They had to get the wood, and they had to burn the wood, and to get the truck charcoal going again. Pots. Pardon?
Charcoal pots.
Charcoal pots.
Mm-hmm.
Uh huh. So the trip that they when they were moving the prisoners to stay away from the Allies and get them the place they wanted to be, and sometimes they'd go and then they'd come back again, and it was a very difficult time those last months of his life. But Bonhoeffer and a group of others were taken to a prison in Buchenwald. And there was a British officer among the prisoners. His name was Payne Best. And he wrote of those last days. And he said that that Bonhoeffer in those days was all humility and sweetness. And that on the morning of April the 8th, he had a. It was the first Sunday after Easter. He had a meditation for the prisoners on the text, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. By his great mercy we have been born anew to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." Best says, "Pastor Bonhoeffer held a little service and spoke to us in a manner which reached the hearts of all, finding just the right words to express the spirit of our imprisonment and the thoughts and resolutions which it had brought. He had hardly finished his last prayer when the door opened and two evil-looking men in civilian uniforms came and said, 'Prisoner Bonhoeffer, get ready to come with us.' Those words, 'come with us,' for all prisoners," Best said, "had come to mean one thing only, the scaffold. We bade him goodbye. He drew me aside. 'This is the end,' he said, 'for me the beginning of life.' He gave me a message to give, if I could, to Bishop Bell and to all of his friends and ecumenical evangelical pastors. He was tried and was hanged at dawn on April the 9th. And just a few days later, that prison site was liberated. Reinhold Niebuhr has called this story a modern Acts of the Apostles. We will want to talk more as we go along about some of the implications of his thought in all of this, but I wanted you to have the life story background before we get into looking at the works themselves. I know you're going to see a movie. The movie will be available of the life the 2 weeks after we complete the course. It'll be the first two Sundays in Lent then. And so you'll get a little review and fancier version of this story then. But I thought really for our purpose in discussing the material, the life story is vitally important. My thought is that next week I want to talk about his theology, especially his understanding of the church and of Christ. And then the following week, think about his work on the life of the Christian, and think there a little bit about life together, that I don't want to get into too much of that because you're going to be working on that during Lent, but the cost of discipleship and ethics. And my intention is to give you in those next two Sundays, and the third we'll do on the prison letters. But my intention is to give you a handout with some of the important quotations from some of that material, so that you get a feel for his language and his perspective, and we'll talk about how that develops and plays out. I think we have a little bit of time for some questions, if there are some. Yes, David.
You mentioned the action of his grandmother. I was wondering how involved the rest of the family was in the opposition.
Very much involved. I mean, several of the family members were involved in the Abwehr, and all of them were against the war. I mean, the family understood from the beginning the danger that Hitler posed for not just Germany but for civilization, and so they were supportive of Bonhoeffer the whole way through, and there was never any tension about that. They were all one mind about it, which was good and helpful for him, because it was encouraging to him. They would bring books to him in prison, and he would communicate with them by underlining a letter on, say, every fifth page or every tenth page, so that his family would get a message from him by deciphering that little code, because he obviously couldn't get much past the guards. He could get some things past the guards because some of the guards were friendly and supportive, but he had some plans there too. Yes, Melanie.
You mentioned that he was working for a resistance that kept him from being directed and working for that. Why did that keep him?
Because he was already working for the government.
So the resistance movement was kind of underground resistance.
Yeah,
it was. He had a front that was actual work. Okay.
Yeah. The Abwehr was a governmental institution. It was a government agency. But these people who were in it, I mean, many of them were important military leaders in German history, but they were trying to overthrow Hitler. So, yes, Paul.
His first visit to America, what did he find, just generally speaking, what did he find lacking in America? What did he find attractive?
Well, I think for one thing, it was the vitality that he saw in the African American community, the vitality in the worship, in the music. I forgot to mention, when I was talking about the seminary, one of the things he did there was to bring his record collection of Negro spirituals and play them, and so that the guys learned them and sang them. But that vitality, I think, was the main thing. He sort of saw the Protestant church where he doesn't really talk very much, I don't think, about Lutheran congregations. I don't know how much contact he had there, because, of course, Union is an interdenominational school. So I don't really know whether how deeply he experienced the Lutheran church in this country, or if he did, it was mainly in New York that he saw it. But I think it was Protestantism in general seemed to him flat and not really engaged with the issues of the times. A disappointment to him in that sense. Yes, Paul.
Carl, was Pastor Niemöller a student in his in confessing seminary or not? And first, no. And secondly, how was he so fortunate to survive?
Well, now Niemöller was the leading pastor in Berlin at this time, and he was a little slow on the uptake. He did get there, but in the early days, Niemöller was not completely with the people in the confessing church. Even when they thought they had some agreement with him about some things slipped through. And of course, all of you, many of you, I'm sure, will remember Niemöller's famous statement about they came for the Jews, and I was not a Jew, so that didn't bother me. They came for the sick, and I was not sick. You know, he goes through this litany, and then they came for me, and there was nobody there to defend me. But Bonhoeffer knew him and was friends with him, and they met and talked sometimes, but it wasn't, I don't think it was the closest of relationships.
I noticed that he was put to death about 30 days before the war ended. Was he in a Berlin prison, or do you know where he was?
Well, he was in a Berlin prison early on, but then as the war began to wind down, they moved the prisoners away, first to Buchenwald and then to Flossenbürg, and Flossenbürg was where he died. But they were trying to get... It looks very much as though, even though it was last minute, this was an intentional killing of Bonhoeffer and these other resistance people, that Hitler's forces, weakened as they were determined that they were going to get rid of these enemies, even though the war was almost over and it was kind of pointless. I mean,
so was it Buchenwald, the one that's just north of Berlin, maybe 40 kilometers or so?
You know, I don't know.
I think that's Buchenwald. Yeah. So it's close, and it's the prison that Hitler built for all the intellectual, primarily for the resistance type people. It was not like Dachau and Auschwitz.
Yeah. Dachau killed 15,000 people in 1933.
Yeah.
Political purpose.
Right.
And that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
That's what I was interested in, what you said about Karl Barth. What was their relationship? They disagreed in office?
Well, there was a little bit of disagreement. I don't know that I can recall the exact point of that, but of course Barth was a great theologian, and Barth was a teacher of Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was interested in Barth's work and studied Barth and knew Barth's theology and all. But also, I guess you'd have to say that Barth was not involved in all of these issues that Bonhoeffer had to be involved in. So there are some instances, I can't recall one now, but there's some instances of conflict, theological conflict between the two of them. Sort of minor stuff, but nonetheless, a little conflict. How are we doing, David, with the time? Are we okay?
About time.
About time to quit. We'll take it. Thank you all very much. See you next week.